What was the first moment when you suddenly realised that these things were being unleashed against you and that things had just sort of turned and changed?
The first moment was the 14th of, no, 11th or 13th of November, when about 9 o'clock in the evening, my mother rang me and was quite distressed. She's 89, lives in Belfast. She rang me, and I was at that moment just utterly horrified.
And what did she ring you to tell you?
To tell me there were reporters at the house. And she was very confused, and it was something to do with my involvement in the death of a child. That moment when I realised they were there in Belfast and that I was on the front of the Belfast Telegraph, I think the next night, I was quite shocked, very, very shocked at that.
And how did it develop? I mean, I've heard that you received death threats and things like that. At what point did that kind of stuff start coming in?
Over the rest of November, I mean, it moved very, very rapidly. And I think just about every day there was something about me. There was something about me in the broadcast media, which was really quite a shock for somebody who's used a private life.
Exactly.
I was shocked at how long the reporters stayed outside my flat.
What time did they arrive?
Well, I eventually worked that out with the help of various neighbours and so on, and they arrived about 7:30
every morning.
And they varied in what time they left at night, but I started a pattern of leaving the house before 6:30. So I was up at 6 and out before 6:30. That's how I got to avoid too many photographs. And then I was coming home once people were able to tell me it was clear to get in. And I came home in various different ways. Sometimes I walked if they were gone. Sometimes I got a cab, paid the cab driver before I got to the door, and then jumped out and got into my flat. There was a point I was quite frightened of them. For a period of that early period, I was afraid. I mean, there were quite gross effects physically, because one morning, actually a Saturday morning before the inspection that I was going into work on the Saturday, I got onto the tube and I'd gone into a real very bad shake, so much so that people in the tube had started to look at me and ask if I was okay, but I was just, you know, really, really shaking hard. And really worked to kind of stop this shaking. But the some of the things that were in the paper, there was a day in which they had a story about my in-laws, which was a real shock. And I think that was a very big turning point in it for a lot of people. And I think colleagues in Haringey were really very shocked at that.
That your in-laws thought you should resign.
Yes,
they?
But there were no in-laws. Yeah. That's the point. There were no in-laws. They weren't there, and there were headlines of, you know, family wanted to go. That was simply not true. They weren't there at all.
I mean, had no family talked to the press at all?
No family had talked to the press. There was a focus on my ex-husband's mother, also in her 80s, but she has assured me absolutely nothing. In fact, she wanted to put a statement out the week after, but as you probably would realise, in the end we said leave it, because it's probably not going to get printed. Now, the incoming mail, just to go on to another aspect of this, the incoming mail to me, I've always been very open, so my mobile number was on my email. So I was getting a long line of, obviously resign, but a lot of very nasty messages, very personal messages. Well, child killer. There was a lot of, if I looked at my BlackBerry as it was, you could see those sorts of headings, you know, on emails coming in. And sometimes I was looking at those going to bed at night. So a lot of those came in. And increasingly I began to realise in the public's mind, they saw me as the person who had killed this child, which was quite a shock. I've got to say that was really very difficult to handle. I sought advice and support from a counsellor to begin to talk about that, and seeing my photograph alongside baby P's photograph, you know, the two would be released together, was quite a shock. The whole council was becoming swamped by incoming mail. And they had, you know, trained people, and they were debriefing people. People were taking very nasty phone calls. Social workers in particular were beginning to find the working with their clients difficult.
Oh, just on a sort of normal day-to-day things, yes. You know, you people are responsible
yes.
for this.
Yes, and why should I cooperate with you, whatever. And I became concerned about the risk to children as well through this. And some of the worst things that I got was someone who clearly had calculated very carefully that, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning is probably a difficult time for most people. And I was getting a series of how to commit suicide arriving in the early part of the, you know, the early
on email or on the phone?
On the phone.
And what did they say?
Well, they gave me various ways that I had started off with 100 ways to commit suicide. And then they would suggest, you know, one. It went on for 3 or 4 mornings, different ways that I could commit suicide.
There was descriptions of the sort of state of the house, you know, all of that kind of, the sort of chaoticness of it, or the chaos of it. Is that when you start to be a social worker, and it's sort of the nature of the job in some ways, you're going into families that are already chaotic and are already, you know, what kind of normality?
Yeah. Yes. In many ways, you've heard descriptions of the home, haven't you? You've heard description of dogs. You've heard descriptions of it smelt of urine, both children and dogs.
Rabbits.
Yes.
And birds. And
yes. Now you've heard some things in the press that I haven't heard as part of the whole process. So you can't always assume that they were right, I'm afraid. So I have read some of that stuff as well, and I've heard some things said about some of the things the men got up to. But if you think, right, here is a home, it's pretty disorganised. There's 4 children in it. You have a young mother, she's 27, 4 children. She's on her own. She's got a number of friends and so on. And you've got a very, very chaotic, disorganised house in terms of when the children go to bed, how they're fed, what they're fed. You've got somebody who's wanting support and accepting support. You've got someone who's split from their partner and the father of the children. And they're getting along as best they can. You've got some of those children at school, and you've got a school who's saying, everything's okay, they're coming to school, they're attending school, but you've also got one little boy who is causing concern. Now, the first time Baby P comes to the notice of the social worker back in 2006, December of 2006, there's absolutely, all the action that was taken was absolutely correct. And when I used the word, the agency's worked effectively, and you've heard that quoted on the television and in the papers, that is when I used that phrase, and they did. And they did work effectively at that point to safeguard the child. And that is absolutely not in any question of that. And the mother was, there were charges pressed against the mother and her mother. And you don't need a perpetrator to decide that a child, you know, needs to come into care. But there was never enough evidence to really pin down what was happening with this child. There are a number of...
What would be the state to which they... I mean, what is the evidence required?
Well, there is a threshold which would set out in some clear detail. But here you had, and this is where I think the biggest issue for the agencies working with this child, is that they had developed a trust in the mother. And that is the serious case review is very clear about that. They had developed a trust in this mother. And they saw a person who was trying to do her best, wanted to accept the support that she was offered, would take the child to different settings, and was really wanting to know, you know, what was wrong with the child. Because there was bruising, there was the event in December when charges were pressed. There was another event in the April when there was some a difference of opinion as to whether this was an accident the child had, a normal toddler accident. And it was concluded that it was. It was concluded that it was. And the there was always agreement among the agencies as to how they move forward. And you would expect those agencies to have robust conversations about children, but there was always agreement. And again, I think that needs to be disputed in some of the things that have been in the newspapers. There was then another event that the social worker reported, the mother in the June, and again thought there was evidence of bruising. But the whole group of professionals, health professionals, around that family and around that child and that mother began to explain things in terms of issues that were possibly within the child. Was there some other medical explanation as to why this was happening? That was the route that began to go. Now, all of that period of time, the police were investigating the case. And the day before Baby P died, told the mother that there was no evidence and the day before the child died, they saw the mother with the social worker and said there was no evidence to press any charges against the mother. And of course the social worker knew that was a case from, you know, some weeks before that, that there was no evidence there. And by the time they all got to that point, they were all focused on getting a medical done for this child, getting the child to specialist health clinic and finding out what was wrong. I was in the room when the police came to tell some of those staff who knew the mother that she had been charged with murder. And I'll remember the scene forever because they simply couldn't believe it. They could not believe that this mother had been charged. And they really needed an explanation from the police as to why on earth she'd been charged with murder, and began to even rationalise that in terms of the police would charge all three, because remember, we didn't know about the men, that the police would charge all three in order, maybe one flushed out, you know, and said, well, you know, it wasn't me, you know, you charged me, it wasn't me. And that's how they rationalised it even then. And one of the huge learning issues, I think, that comes out of this is this. I mean, people in social care talk about the rule of optimism. You can talk in any walk of life about the rule of optimism, can't you? That they were operating with this rule of optimism that this mother was working with them. And there was huge, I say there was huge deceit. I don't know to this day what the mother knew and understood either, because I think that's another element of this, isn't it?
And when you heard that he died, how did you hear and what was your reaction?
My deputy came in the room and told me, and we were absolutely horrified, absolutely shocked. It was our one greatest fear. Yeah, child deaths. The public now know that sadly, larger numbers of children are killed by their parents than the public ever realised. And when you get a child has died is known to us in is on our at-risk register. That's the biggest horror that could have been. And we knew the size of that. Whatever the issues had been, whatever our conduct had been in the case, we knew the size of a case like that. And that was a Friday afternoon. Friday afternoon that we got that message, and we knew that there was going to be a preliminary post-mortem in Great Ormond Street on the Monday, and we expected to hear more about how the child had died on the Monday. But what happened that weekend really was quite a shock, because there was a major information was given to the press from the police that weekend. In a way that we hadn't expected it. So there was some very, very difficult information in the press that was new to me, the first time I had read it in the press.
What was that?
About the injuries to the child, which were...
Did anybody call you about it?
No, these were quite shocking. You know, and of course the child had shocking injuries, but it must have come from someone who was either present at the first preliminary look at the child, because the police would have been called, of course, and it must have come from someone who was there or reported it back to others who then told it to the press. So that was that weekend. And
what would you say your overriding emotion was at the time? Would it be sort of fear or defensiveness?
Well, the death of the child is you know, that's uppermost, isn't it? Death of a child, and then to have some idea of what the circumstances were. This child has been murdered. The child has been found dead at home, has been murdered, and we know this child, we know who the social worker is. So again, we, you know, had to speak with the social worker, and her line managers spoke with her, and she was very deeply shocked, just completely unable to handle that incoming information, because she had seen the child so recently and spoken to the mother so recently, and couldn't understand how on earth he could be dead and murdered. So there was the thing about the child. There was also the issue about stability, holding the department steady. That was very big in my mind, and very big in my deputy's mind. And the two of us spent some time specifically talking about how we were going to hold the department steady. Because people, other social workers, knew the size of this. And if you're not careful, you begin to lose your staff. And the department could go into meltdown, basically, and could go into being in a very unsafe place. The other thing we did was make sure, as you would expect us to, that every single one of the children on the at-risk register, because here we were finding a social worker who was utterly shocked. And you've got to immediately think, wow, what about the others? So there was an immediate look at every single child that week, and you know, a dialogue with everyone, every social worker, to make sure that we were all secure with those children. The council had its statement that it wanted to give to the press. It had a set of words it wanted me to read. It had confidence in me doing that, and I obviously wasn't looking forward to it, but I knew and felt it was my responsibility again to step up to that role and to try to explain to the public what had happened. And it was a complete disaster, which I fully recognise, and despite all that's happened to me, I don't hold any one person responsible for the disaster that it was, and I think a lot of people will feel very bad about that. The reporting restrictions weren't lifted on her mother, the child's mother, baby P's mother, her boyfriend, or the lodger, and that left me as the only image in the press, and I think we should have spotted that. We hadn't done any kind of risk assessment at all. We knew that we were going to get some difficult press from some parts of the press who wouldn't want to maybe listen to what we had to say.
What was the basis for the restrictions?
It's partly to protect the children, other children, the siblings, and it was also, I believe, in case there was another case. There were other possible charges against them. I'm not terribly sure of the detail of why that happened. So, for example, if you look at what happened after the Shannon Matthews case, it was Karen Matthews who was the image, not their director. So here I was the only image in the press, and of course it took some days for the penny to drop. Now, we should have realised that when we knew those reporting restrictions weren't going to be lifted. We'd also expected that the police would brief the press around the same day, i.e. after the case, but they had briefed the press beforehand, I think a couple of days, I'm not entirely sure, but certainly maybe a couple of days, and I think the press, by the time we faced them in that room, were feeling a bit angry that maybe we hadn't said anything, because we'd maintained total silence until I opened my mouth at that press briefing, and I think that probably had a bearing on it as well. The police had also released the 3D graphic of a baby, we remember, to show injuries. And I think when I look at what the public were hearing and seeing, it was no surprise that they felt as they did at such a brutal murder of a child. I'd felt that way myself, albeit some time earlier when I heard the detail. All sorts of things were said about me, that I was waving statistics around, which I certainly never did. Clearly I was questioned about resignation and said that I wasn't intending, but I was quoted as, I am certainly not going to. I mean, that was
what
not
did you
said.
Say?
I say that I wasn't intending to resign. I'd already covered the issue about the social workers, so there seemed to be some pressures to, you know, why no one had been sacked. I would absolutely emphasise the sadness of the fact that what I understand is that there's a child dying every 10 days at the hands of their family or their extended family. It's actually during the aftermath of Baby P that was actually shown to be more than that. Now, if you are going to sack every director of every children's service where there is a child deaf, you're going to turn them over at a rate of a third a year, irrespective of what their role had been and what the conduct of their staff had been. And remember that the director, whilst they have a leadership role for all of the agencies who protect children, they are not responsible for those other professions, so health agencies and police.
Just to go back to the actual sort of press conference and the sort of physical experience of it, and just how it worked. I mean, the basic impression that you would have got as a sort of public, somebody in the public, and reading newspapers and stuff like that, there was the kind of harp going on about, she didn't say sorry. And where did that come from? I mean, was there a deliberate, was it part of the strategy of dealing with it, or what was going on there exactly?
Again, looking back on it, we had the council's words they wanted used.
Was the word sorry in those words?
No. And in a sense, you sort of think, my goodness, it wasn't. You know, I thought about that, well, in some ways, we were so sorry and distressed about this, we almost did not say that. That's why we were there, in a sense, because we were so sorry and distressed. But there was nobody was more sorry and distressed than I was to be sitting there telling this to the public, you know, through the press representatives. And it's almost as if we just didn't say it. And there was a point in this press conference, or press briefing, when the person who was sort of chairing it was, you know, bringing in people who were constantly, you know, wanting to come in with questions and trying to manage it. And there was a point at which someone had asked me some questions over to my right, and then this chair had drawn in someone of my left, and I turned away. And as I started to take this question, the person was saying, would I apologise to the father, you see? And it almost got lost as this other person started to speak, and I picked up and began to reply to that question. And once I'd taken my attention away, this person, I don't know where they were, who they were from, said, well, that's a no then. And actually, I think that was a grave mistake. And I think that probably made people angry. And we probably should
mistake
have gone back.
Mistake on your part.
Yes. We should have gone back to it. Mm. And had I done, I would have said that we'd had good contact with the father. The father had been seen by social workers, been seen by my senior staff. He'd been asked to contribute to the series case review if he wished. He did decline. And we also clearly wrote to him and given him our condolences.
So who do you hold responsible for the recklessness? The media?
A number of people. Press and politics. Press, I mean, I was shocked at how fast, I mean, maybe I shouldn't have been shocked, I was shocked at how fast it became a party political issue, both locally and nationally. And now you've got this, you know, a local tragedy and a national catastrophe. You know, that's the other thing, that's the other way I've been explaining it to myself, that's what we've got. And we have to come out of it, we have to move on from here.
When you say you knew that you had to go... Was that before Ed Balls made his statement?
I agreed that, because I could see the pressure not only in my department, and, you know, people working flat out to deal with all the, you know, nasty incoming stuff and phone calls and so on. I could see the impact on the council, We were nearly being brought to a standstill, and you can't do that in a council. I began to see that others would be thinking there's only one way out of this, that she, you know, we're going to have to take Sharon out of this. And in the end, I said, well, if the report is very bad, then I, of course, would go on mutual agreement, I will go. Was devastated by that.
What do you think, what's your lowest point been?
I would say, not in a dramatic way, because I don't think it is dramatic, but you know, when anyone's in that kind of situation, you do consider how to stop it all. You know, you can't just walk off the end of the tube platform and stop it all, and I certainly did think about that on occasion. And there was certainly another occasion in the middle of the night when I gathered up all the paracetamol that existed in the house. There was nothing like enough. I don't think I would have done it, because I think I was thinking too rationally still, because what I was thinking about was, you get me again, I'm not careful, my daughters, yeah, and thinking about my mother, you know. So I think I was too rational, you know, looking back. But I think it's natural. That's how I've looked at it. It would have been a natural thing to think about, because you were there thinking, you know, I can't bear another minute of this, and you just think, well, you know, I could just keep walking. And it becomes attractive. There's a point when it becomes attractive. And then you think about all, you know, the aftermath of that. So I certainly was still very rational. I mean, maybe I should have resigned when, at the beginning. I think people would have been quite horrified, who knew me, if I had. When would I have done that? Would I have resigned because of the public pressure, which in the end did push me out? What do we do when young people are dying from knife crime? Whose responsibility is that? Had there been a child, a young person, died of knife crime, should I have resigned? I was dismissed, and I didn't get my 3 months in lieu of notice, so I came out with nothing, and I had no means of income whatsoever, either from any employment or from pensions.
You can't get it into your 60s, is that right?
I don't have any pensions. I have, through the support of a number of friends and family, I have a period of time in which I can survive until I get a job. I like many people in the country, have all of my any asset I have in the flat I live in. Of course, that can be sold, which it probably will be. It's been severely rocked in my health, mental and physical health, but I think I'm kind of on recovering, and I will go from here. I have to do. I don't have a choice. But I've got two brilliant daughters who, you know, push me along when I need pushed along. They're just outstanding.
And I think this is my last question. It's about public pressure and what the Sun did, and the degree to which we are allowing public campaigns to affect policy and thence to affect people who are at risk. The Ed Balls and the government would probably say that, you know, they made an absolutely independent decision. The Sun claims it as their victory. Who's right?
Well, I think I was squashed between the press and politics. That's what I think.
But is the politics being shoved around by the press?
I'm not going to answer your question directly because I don't think I can. Mm. But I think what I would say to you is I think there are a number of people who need to quietly reflect on what it was they did in this whole story. And be open onto themselves as to how they behaved and why they behaved as they did, and to understand, not to blame them, but to understand why they behaved as they did, and to show greater courage the next time around.